Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 5 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He's held positions with the Virginia State Police and General Electric. He's here to talk to us about cybersecurity and technology. Representing the great city of Richmond, Virginia, please welcome Chris Cruz. Chris, how are we doing?
Good, Jason. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I just thought of, were you born and raised in Richmond?
I was not actually. I was actually born in Long Island, New York, and then moved around a lot. So just ended up in Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, very good. Is Richmond there? I'm always impressed with how big population-wise Richmond is. It doesn't seem like it should be that big, and it's pretty large.
Yeah, it's a very deceptive city. It's bigger than most people think, I think.
Yeah, and then you got the, what do they call that? The fan?
Or yeah, five the fan. Points. Yeah, we got the fan and the parks and everything. I actually live right in the city. So I live in the neighborhood right adjacent to the fan called Bird Park.
All right. Well, let's get into the interview then. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Yeah, sure. So I originally went to school for criminal justice. I was really interested in pursuing kind of a law enforcement career in some capacity. I do wear glasses, in fact, pretty thick glasses, and pretty convinced I could never pass a firearms eye exam. So I had always assumed, you know, some kind of analytical career would be the path I would take to get there.
And then so how did you get into the state police in terms of working for the Fusion Center?
Yeah, sure. So graduated college, degree in criminal justice, wasn't sure what to do. Actually ended up working for the American Red Cross doing emergency management and disaster response work. So hurricane relief and all that fun stuff. I did that for a year and then ended up landing a job in a little IT company that actually specialized in providing services to law enforcement and intelligence community customers. And from there, I saw an opportunity at the state police. I actually took a part-time job there. I gave up my full-time job and benefits and all that stuff and took a part-time role to get my foot in the door as a part-time analyst in the Fusion Center and then just kind of had a lot of success from there.
Wow, that was a risk, wasn't it?
It definitely was. Yeah, it was a big gamble. I crunched the numbers on, you know, how much money I'd be losing, but I was just so vested and so interested in getting into the Fusion Center and being a law enforcement analyst. I wanted to take the gamble and it definitely paid off in the long run.
Well, that's awesome. So how long did you work part-time before you got on full-time?
Yeah, I worked as a part-time analyst for, I want to say maybe 5 months before a full-time role opened up. There was actually two full-time roles that opened up at the same time. And both supervisors kind of approached me and said, hey, you've been doing a really great job. We really like having you part of the team. You know, there's two roles opening up. We're really interested in having you. And they were almost kind of vying for me, competing to see which one I would choose. One role was in the terrorism intelligence unit. And the other one was in the gang intelligence unit. And after some discussion, you know, with the leaders and myself, decided to go with the gang route. And so that's how I got my first full-time role there.
All right. Interesting. And then what are some of your tasks then as you're starting out in organized crime?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of kind of strategic intelligence gathering. So analyzing crime reports and trend reports from different parts of the state, of the Commonwealth of Virginia, looking for patterns in those and then kind of formulating, you know, ideas on things that law enforcement partners should be looking out for, as far as identifying members of street gangs or organized crime syndicates, and then also just supporting kind of ongoing investigations. So I did a lot of casework for different task force members and other groups investigating kind of, you know, statewide crime and even some international crime groups as well.
You said you started out with the National Center of Crisis and Continuity Coordination, mm-hmm. and that is just dealing with technical support for law enforcement emergency management. So how did that job help you with what you eventually went on to do for the Fusion Center?
Yeah, I think it was pretty influential role in a couple of ways. It let me see kind of this wide breadth of things that law enforcement and emergency management and even some intelligence agencies, you know, the kind of work they do. I got to essentially manage a whole different grouping of portals and websites that these groups were using to share information, to support, you know, national initiatives, all kinds of interesting stuff. And so I got to see this really great breadth of work that, you know, law enforcement, emergency management get to participate in. And then at the same time, I got to flex a little bit of my technology skills as well on the back end. And so I think bringing those two influences to the table is what made me kind of a, I guess, a worthwhile candidate, you know, for the part-time role. And then it just made everything just felt so much more familiar when I got into law enforcement. I knew all these different websites. I knew all these different information sharing platforms already. I knew how they worked even on the back end. So felt like I had a little bit of an advantage going into it.
Now, are you classically trained in technology or you just picked it up as you go?
Yeah, I am not classically trained. I technically don't have a degree in computer science or anything like that. I was always, I guess, a very nerdy person, even when I was young, really into technology, really into anything computer-ish. My father, not a computer nerd, but a big technology nerd. I think he was one of the first people I certainly ever knew to own it, like a digital camera. He's always been been into the bleeding edge of technology, I guess. And so I guess that just rubbed off on me. And so I've just always been sort of a technologist at heart and picked up a lot of stuff on my own along the way that just, you know, worked out.
Yeah, it's funny looking back now. Digital cameras seem like they were popular for about 5 minutes.
It is. It's funny when I remember in college, people walking around carrying a cell phone and a digital camera separately everywhere they went.
Yeah. And I know they were more popular longer than what I'm thinking of, but it's funny to think about that in the past. I was like, they were probably already considered outdated years ago. It's probably been a decade or something like that. I can't remember when the last time I even bought one. So,
yeah.
All right. So this is going to bring us to the analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the case or project that an analyst works on. That's their career defining moment, if you will. And so, Chris, what would you consider is your career defining moment at this time?
Yeah, for sure. I think I definitely attribute it to a case I worked as an analyst at the Virginia Fusion Center, the Virginia State Police. There was a special agent who worked out in a very rural area of Virginia, and he got this case kind of as a tip that came into the state police, and he was not the most tech savvy guy. He recognized that about himself, and so he reached out to the Fusion Center and said, hey, you know, I just need, you know, a really good technical analyst to help out with this case. And the director threw it immediately in my lap and said, Chris, you're the techiest guy we know. Go ahead and see what you can do to help this agent. And so the case ended up being a really unique investigation. It was actually a local law enforcement officer who was actually working for three different departments at the same time and essentially embezzling, or he was charged with embezzling funds. Basically because he was clocking into two or three departments and then going and hanging out on a lake or going boating or doing other things that I'm not supposed to be doing while collecting multiple paychecks.
So not only was he clocking in to multiple places, he wasn't even working?
Exactly, yeah. To me, it was just a lot of work to defraud, but I guess it was his prerogative, right?
A hell of a boat, right?
Exactly. Hell of a hobby for sure. But the thing that kind of made the case was they got the court order to pull kind of phone pings, and the agent didn't want to do that himself. So he actually had all the ping data come to me. So every day for over the course of 4 weeks, it was every 5 minutes between the hours of 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., I would get an email from the cell phone provider with a date, a time, a latitude, and a longitude, and that was it. And I had to collect all that data, put it together. I started by manually copying and pasting it all, which I quickly realized was a nightmare scenario. And so I ended up, you know, again, flexing on some of my tech skills, actually ended up writing a script in Visual Basic and putting it as a macro in Excel. And it would basically automatically scrape the data from the emails, dump it into a spreadsheet. And so it was done. And so nice. Just run that once a day in the mornings when I came in, did all the heavy lifting for me. And I just got to focus on, you know, the analytics part of it. And so we basically, you know, analyzed the locations, the cell towers that were being pinged off of, put it all together in a series of maps. I think I printed eight huge, like 14 foot, or maybe like 6 by 6 foot maps. 14 is a little too big. 6 by 6 foot maps, and put them together for this agent. And then we kind of poured over all the data to make sure we were accurate, we were correct, everything checked out. We kind of put it together in this big package, and we took it to the Commonwealth's attorney that was going to prosecute the case. They took my maps and they put them on these big, I guess, cardboard board cutouts, and they had them on easels in a room. And they brought in the officer who was charged with this crime, who had, you know, in all these conversations before that, denied any involvement, you know, stood fast by his innocence. As soon as he walked in the room and saw all these giant maps with his location, all these pings right around this lake that he had been spending so much time at, they said his face turned white. He immediately changed his plea to guilty and was immediately seeking, you know, some kind of a plea deal or agreement. So for me, it was the first time where I got to, you know, flex, you know, some technology skills to do something that just seemed really cool, to kind of automate some of that process for myself. And then combine that with my analytical skills to not just help, you know, bring a case to closure, but drive a complete change in the way that case was going to go. They were dead set on, you know, taking it to trial and going through the whole thing. And they said, you know, thanks to those maps and all that data you guys put together, completely changed the game and allowed us to kind of close this case easy peasy.
Nice. So let's go back to writing the script then, because I'm assuming you wrote the script because your department didn't have any kind of telephone toll analysis software, correct?
Correct. Yeah. At the time, we had nothing, certainly nothing that I had access to that was able to do it. So yeah, it was a bit of a learning curve. I had done some scripting when I was much younger, like in maybe middle school, high school, kind of self-teaching myself. Some slightly more sketchy things on the internet for sure, but it was kind of fun to pull back those old skills and use them, you know, in the workplace, but not just in the workplace, but to help solve a crime essentially.
Yeah, and it's also nice that your department gave you the ability to do that, because you get into admin rights and some of that stuff, some of these departments lock you down from writing any kind of scripts like that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And they were very supportive. And in fact, what I developed, we ended up reusing it a couple other times for other analysts who were in the exact same position. So it was really nice to see it become kind of a tool that could be used.
All right. So you set the schedule, and it was just there when you got in the morning, you read the email, it plucked all the stuff from it, organized it for you, and voila, it was there.
Yeah. So basically it was set up to there was a particular command I would use to execute it. But once I executed it, it would connect to my Outlook account, scan through a specific folder where all these email pings had been dumped into, and it would look for those four key lines that had that date, time, latitude, longitude, and it would just copy and paste each one by one, put it in the right spot in a spreadsheet, and it could churn through, you know, 1,000 emails in, you know, probably less than an hour. Wasn't the most efficient script for sure, but certainly functional and doing a few hundred at a time each day. Just run it each morning when I came in, and then everything for the previous day was done. So it just made my life infinitely easier.
Yeah. So you had some kind of job set up on your email to automatically send these emails to a particular folder?
Yeah, essentially just set up a rule in Outlook and said, if this is the exact subject line, just dump it into this folder and then point to the script at that folder.
All right. Interesting. Now, I did a little bit with those scripts on the back end when I was back. I'm going to age myself, but we used to get telephone toll records, and they would give it to you by day in a different tab. Mm-hmm. So you could get an Excel spreadsheet. It would have like 100 tabs on it for each day that you had. Or if you scanned it and had to clean the data, and you scanned in the hard copy telephone tolls that you got, it would give like one tab at a time. Right. Yeah. And so I remember I wrote, just recorded a macro in Excel, got it to bring it all into one tab. So it was one set of data instead of all the different tabs worth of data. And then I remember just going on the back end with the script there, and then just manipulating it as the future whenever I needed it, mm-hmm. right, to do it that. And that's the extent that I've had. So I am really, really impressed with what you were just describing to me that you were able to do, especially just self-taught.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it was definitely a learning experience. dusting off some old skills, and I had never quite done anything quite like that before, but it all worked out in the end, which is great.
To the investigation itself, it seems a little bit of overkill that they went to this to prove that this guy was signing off and fooling around and doing all this other stuff. It just seems like there should have been a little bit of supervision able to be had here to let them know that, like, okay, he's where he's supposed to in the city with his uniform on, not, you know, fishing in the lake.
Yeah, I think we had to over-engineer it a little bit to make up for kind of a lack of supervision I'm imagining that they were dealing with.
Certainly got terminated. Did he serve time?
He did, I believe. I believe he was sentenced to... I want to say 2+ years.
Okay. Wow. That's actually more than what I would have guessed.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think a big part of it was the amount of money they felt he had successfully embezzled.
Wow. So yeah. So how much was that, or how long had he been doing this?
Ooh, I don't remember the exact number, sure. But he had been doing it for months. It had been many 6+ months at least.
Huh.
I guess the big question is just how quiet were these rural areas that he was policing where he was able to get away with this?
It just seems so, I don't know. It seems so outrageous that you had to call in telephone toll analysis to make sure that an employee was doing their job. But yeah. Hey, you got her done, and you learned a lot from it. So good deal. So let's move on then, because you end up leaving the Fusion Center. Mm-hmm. And taking a role with General Electric. So I definitely want to talk about transitioning from the public sector to the private sector.
Yeah, the transition from, you know, State Police, the Fusion Center to General Electric, hands down, one of the hardest things I ever did. That public-private transition was tough. It was really a culture shock when I got to General Electric, just a completely different way of doing business, of doing work. My role when I went to General Electric was working on the insider threat team. So still doing analytics and supporting investigations, but instead of focusing on traditional criminals, we were really focusing on internal theft of company intellectual property and proprietary data. So mm-hmm. people stealing designs for wind turbines or power and turbines, or, you know, jet engines that are used on military aircraft, things like that. So it's just a different way of thinking about work, but still applying so many of the same analytical and investigative and case support type skills I developed as a law enforcement analyst.
Yeah, they were impressed by that 6-foot by 6-foot map that you did.
I told that same story during my interview. They loved it because, you know, looking for, you know, internal threats like that, you know, they took it as, you know, law enforcement, I guess, squeaking out bad guys within law enforcement to some degree. So it went well with them.
Did you pursue this position, or did GE contact you? How did you get to the point of being hired?
Yeah, I think if I remember correctly, I did pursue this position. I was actually inspired. There are two other people that I worked with who were at the Fusion Center. I have a friend named, you know, Charles Kennedy, another friend named Ben Carver, both left the Fusion Center prior to me and had gone to GE. And I just happened to kind of stumble across the role that was open there and reached out to them and said, hey, this role looks pretty interesting. You know, insider threat sounds really cool. Can you guys tell me, like, you know, is it fun over there? Is it nice? Is it worth going? Are you miserable? And they were like, it's awesome here. We really like it. We think you'll like it too. Come on over if you're interested. So applied and went through a long interview process, but ended up getting the role, which is really fun.
Yeah. So then you mentioned that it's different. So I guess, how was it different?
Yeah, I think it was, first of all, it was so much more fast paced. I think law enforcement, not as much as other government agencies, but still has some of that, you know, government bureaucracy and red tape that we see that kind of slows things down, particularly, you know, advancing technology or buying new tools, all that kind of stuff. When I got to GE, you know, if we needed a tool, they just bought it. Sometimes mm-hmm. they bought stuff we didn't even ask for, and we just had to figure out how to use it. Not always, you know, the best spending plan, I guess, in the private sector, but money was never really an object, which was really just interesting. It was never a wall. You never hit this wall of like, we can't solve this problem because we're missing a tool. If we hit that point, they said, all right, well, let's get the tool, or let's find a similar tool, or let's enhance an existing tool. There was an immense amount of thought into constantly moving forward and avoiding roadblocks and stoppages and things like that. So that was just a totally different pace of work for me, I think. And then the other thing that was really critical in GE and other private sector places I've been in as well, really the focus on the customer. And even though I was doing security, I was doing investigations, you know, we were doing cases that we were referring to the FBI for people to be, you know, arrested and tried for theft of data and intellectual property. But we still kind of treated the work we did as having a customer. And for us, you know, our customer satisfaction still determined our success, even if our customer was the FBI or if our customer was an internal, you know, physical investigations team or some other IT security team. And so incorporating that concept of not building processes or analytical programs in a silo, but instead building them and then challenging the customer, whoever it is that's receiving those products to validate whether or not, you know, they like it, they want it, it's useful, was a different way of doing work as well that I've kind of carried with me ever since.
Yeah. Now, at this time, is it already established how you work with the FBI? You know, you're gathering so much information at GE, and then you're essentially laying the case to the FBI. Is that already established, or is that something that you're having to create the process?
It was definitely something we had to build out. So when I joined the Insider Threat Team at GE, I was actually the third person ever to join the team. It was brand new. So we were lucky in that one of our team members was a former FBI analyst up in Northern Virginia, but we had to kind of build a lot of inroads and opportunities with the FBI over time. And it was not easy, you know. When you work in law enforcement or any kind of public sector, people are pretty open about sharing information with someone like the FBI, you know, minus the opportunities, I guess, when they swoop in and take your case or something like that, which has happened to me for sure. But, you know, people don't hesitate, I guess, necessary to share information from law enforcement to law enforcement. But in private sector, we had to jump through a dozen hurdles with legal and privacy and general counsel about what we could say to the FBI and how do we say it and when do we say it and what level of detail are we allowed to share. There was just so much more legal nuance we had to learn, honestly, to navigate that relationship and just grow it slowly. But it did get to a point where it actually started going both ways. We actually had the FBI coming to us and letting us know about concerning activity that we needed to investigate. And so to get that kind of tip off from them was definitely a win.
Are you allowed to talk about anything in particular? Because I'm trying to, just for our audience and even me myself, just get a better understanding. Are you allowed to talk about a particular case?
Yeah, definitely. I can definitely give an example of some of the instances or cases that have been worked. So I guess I'm gonna pull from ones that I know kind of made it into the news cycle. So there was, so GE, you know, huge company, makes tons of different types of products and machines. You know, the big joke is anything that spins, GE makes it. So wind turbines, MRI machines, you know, power turbines, all are based on spinning. And so that's GE's specialty, I guess. One of the critical components of some of that technology is, you know, deep into the electronics of the system. So we're talking about, you know, the transistors and the processors, the semiconductors in particular, that kind of make the little circuit boards and all these machines work. That's where kind of a lot of our secret sauce exists. We call it crown jewels, kind of that most sensitive data that we can't release to anyone. And so there's a particular, you know, type of material. It's not a secret. I can say the name of the material. It's called silicon carbide. And it's kind of mined and processed in a few different parts of the world. GE has patented a number of ways of kind of processing it, very efficient at incorporating it into semiconductor technology that's used in dozens of electronic applications. At GE, we have tons of R&D labs, people who are researching and inventing new things. We had someone working in one of these labs who was working on the silicon carbide processes, basically package up a ton of data and send it off to a contact in China with the Chinese government. And so this is obviously huge red flags. You might think, well, it's just, you know, material sciences. It's just some R&D material. But when we realize that technology is not just used in the MRI machines that we build or that GE builds, I should say, but it's also used in, you know, military aircraft, fighter jets, potentially used in certain types of maybe weapons or missile applications, computers that are in submarines, maybe all kinds of military applications. So when it goes to a foreign government, obviously it becomes a very concerning issue. We actually worked dozens of cases in which we had scientists or researchers share kind of sensitive internal data tied to national security issues, tied to kind of critical technologies, and share those to foreign governments, share them either through jobs they were applying to in foreign governments, or sometimes just straight up, spycraft, dead drops and all that old fashioned fun stuff. And so trying to trace these cases down, but do them in a way where, we validate the actual loss or potential loss of intellectual property was kind of the core of what we did.
What was the ratio of like, okay, they are purposely trying to sell this information versus more of an innocent, like ignorant maybe way of going about business? We're like, oh, I didn't even think about that breaking the protocol, but yeah, I did it.
Totally. That is a really great question. That's a very insightful question from the, insider threat perspective. I can honestly say probably 90% of insider cases probably are attributed to accident. I didn't realize I was moving the data. I didn't realize the data was that sensitive, things like that. A lot of people take data just because they feel like they own it. They feel like it's part, they worked on it for 10 years, 20 years. They feel like they have a stake in it. And so they would retire and they would just take 20 gigs of data with them out the door just to sit in their basement or their garage until they died probably. But they just feel this sense of ownership. And so we worked a lot of those cases, and I had a number of cases I worked where, we find something that looks horrible, looks malicious, it looks like it's going to be a bad day for everybody. And then we get all the way down to doing the interview with the employee, and it was just an accident, just a happy accident, it just happened to happen, nothing malicious at all. And so our insider threat efforts and, at other places I've done insider threat work or insider threat consulting, I've always said it's not about identifying people. It's just about identifying concerning behavior. And then you investigate that behavior to determine, the intent behind it. But all investigations start out with something bad happened. Let's figure out how bad it really is versus looking for bad people. We're never going to easily find bad people, but we can easily identify, bad behavior on the network.
I had a guy I knew once. He was working for a security firm and he was heavy into the probably similar situation to what you were dealing with some of these scientists. And he ended up having a really crazy weekend in Vegas the one time and ended up failing his polygraph the next time he got a polygraph. And so that he was pulled, so he couldn't work on all the stuff that he was supposed to be working on, right? And he no longer had the clearance, and so it was a lot like his, right? Like, this is my project, how are you going to take me off for this? And there was a lot of back and forth, and then so it was like 6 months he had to go through all this. But he said it was so ridiculous because they told him that he couldn't work on it, but then they would he's working this whatever they had him or had him do, which was something simple, but they would come talk to him and say, hey, we're stuck here.
Can you give us some advice?
Yeah. So he couldn't work on it, but they would come ask him questions about it. He said it was so weird.
Well, yeah, we don't know what to do. Blink once for yes and twice for no.
I guess then, did you ever have to testify for GE?
I did not. I don't believe in my time there, we came close. We had a one person who was prepped to testify for a significant case and then plea change at the last minute. I went through, I think, a tiny bit of training at one point with legal because we thought I might have to testify for a case I was working. But I think if I remember correctly, that was a case where the person actually fled the country, went back to their homeland. So we had to kind of handed off everything to FBI and said, it's kind of your problem now. We can't touch the person in any way now. So really for us, I think it was a goal, as analysts and supporting our investigative team, we were really the technical investigators in the process, but a big goal was to make sure we would never have to testify. That was kind of the ideal scenario.
Well, and then you eventually come back to the Commonwealth and you are currently the cybersecurity program manager with the Office of Public Safety and Homeland Security in Virginia. So then you're back in the public sector, right? So did you just decide the private sector wasn't for you?
Yeah. So it was, it's interesting to come back for sure. I think the private sector has tons of benefits and it's definitely a better fit for some people and some personalities. But I think for me, I've always been driven by the mission, I guess, which sounds silly when I say it, but I like being a part of that, you know, something that's bigger than me, I guess. And that's, you can find that in private sector for sure. It's just harder. I loved working for GE, for example, but, you know, one of the biggest drivers was it's a public company. So, you know, the stock price becomes one of the most important facets. And if something's going to impact the stock price, that sort of takes priority over, you know, an investigation or some security initiative sometimes. So it's hard to balance that when, you know, me being this classically trained, you know, law enforcement analyst, I just want to catch bad guys, really. I don't care about the other business side of the house so much. I just want to do cool stuff and catch bad guys and have awesome stories to tell. So finding that in private sector was a little harder. And so that's, I think, what lured me back to public sector, the opportunity to work on big, crazy stuff that I would just never get to see the light of day of, you know, somewhere else.
All right. And this gets into cybersecurity. So what kind of things are you getting into?
Yeah, for sure. So in my current role, I wear many hats, but I basically help kind of build out or grow, you know, cybersecurity capabilities, you know, across different parts of Virginia, usually those that have kind of a significant intersection with public safety. So I'm helping build out kind of a cyber incident response group that who kind of covers the whole state. And, you know, if any locality or municipal entity were hit by a ransomware attack or some kind of significant hacking incident, and they didn't have the resources to respond to it themselves, they could call the state, they can call the state police. And we have a whole team with representatives from a bunch of different agencies, state, local, federal, you name it, who kind of swing in. I always call them the Avengers. They just kind of surge together to help people, you know, in a cyber crisis, so to speak. I do a lot of outreach and engagement with locality partners through some of our other state agencies, try and just kind of evangelize cybersecurity in a lot of different areas. And then I do a lot of work specifically with the Virginia Department of Emergency Management, where I kind of own the state's cyber incident response plan and building out a number of capabilities and programs that are associated with that as well. So my biggest interest is kind of merging the capabilities of emergency management and cybersecurity into one sort of cohesive program that we can offer.
Yeah, it's interesting because as you're talking there, I'm thinking, wow, you're really right on the line there of you're working for a state-run facility, but you're also talking about security and security threats, which is normally historically a private sector capacity. Mm-hmm. Seems like there's a lot of education going on, making sure that like people and businesses are aware of the possible threat of cybersecurity.
Yeah, tons of engagement opportunities where we, you know, it's kind of a multi-pronged attack that we try and take, where part of it is, you know, encouraging, you know, for example, small and medium businesses or really small rural localities. Hey, you know, cybersecurity is really important. And you know, most people look at cybersecurity incidents as a matter of, you know, when and not if. You know, it's probably going to happen at some point. It's just a matter of how long until it happens. And so we're trying to convince a lot of places to take some time to invest in technology and cybersecurity specifically. You'd be surprised. There are some, you know, rural places where, you know, the person in charge of IT security is also the person in charge of the library, and he's also the comptroller or something like that. you know, some of these rural areas, they wear many hats, and cybersecurity in particular becomes one of a laundry list of job duties they have. And so we're really trying to get people to think about investing more resources into cybersecurity. The other facet is we're trying to really raise awareness among leaders. So people like county administrators, state leaders, state agency leaders, but also, you know, legislative staff, even legislators in Virginia and in the General Assembly, trying to help them recognize, you know, the critical risks and threats we face in the cybersecurity space, and how we need support. We need more personnel. We need money. We need new technology. You know, sometimes we get it, but sometimes we don't. And it's kind of a roll of the dice. I guess, to see how the spending plans turn out each year sometimes, but we're trying to fight those fights to get more resources and funding available. And then the third part of that attack is the individual, trying to educate individuals to just recognize that they have a role to play in cybersecurity. It's no longer an issue that you can just offset to your IT person or that tech guy who's in the corner in your office, like I was when I was at Fusion Center. You have an investment. You have a role to play. We all kind of have some degree of ownership of cybersecurity. If you click a malicious link in a phishing email, it's kind of your fault. And so not to say that, you know, certainly not to do any kind of victim blaming, but you could be the attack vector that could take down a whole agency, a whole network. And you can avoid that by just having a little bit of education, a little bit of awareness about cybersecurity as a whole. So those kind of hit the three areas that we're trying to educate on.
Is that mostly how they get in? Is through basically somebody that's authorized lets them in?
Yes. So there are a variety of statistics on this, but the one that seems the most accurate to me is they say about 90% of all cyber attacks start as a phishing email. So clicking a bad link and a bad email, whether you did it accidentally or maliciously, I suppose, but whether you did it unwittingly, that's how 90% of pretty much all cyber attacks occur. And that stays true even when you look at Nigerian scammers trying to make a quick buck versus, you know, advanced, what they call, you know, the APT, the advanced persistent threat, which is, you know, organized military hacking groups from Russia or China or North Korea. They're using the same phishing techniques as well. So the reality is that it just works so well. And that's why people use it.
Yeah. And they're getting good though. We get them at work, and there's been a couple of times that I had to catch myself. Right. It was, I got one recently here where it was talking about a meeting request. The alias that was given on the email was a coworker of mine.
Yeah.
Right. But if you looked at the actual email address, it wasn't from, you know, it wasn't from Vanderbilt. But I had to take oh, this person's sending me a request. All right. And then I started looking to where I was clicking to accept. I was really going through there, and it was almost one of those people that would have hit the button and, you know, would have been in a ton of trouble. But
oh yeah.
So they're getting, it's not as blatant as, you know, the, you know, what you said, the Nigerians.
Yeah, they're not all that easy to spy.
Right. So, all right, well, let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk a little bit more about technology, some of the upcoming threats that analysts may be exposed to, and get your advice for the analysts. And we're going to play Don't Be That Analyst. You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Utter. We'll be right back. Happy anniversary, ILEA, International Association of Law Enforcement Intelligence Analysts, turns 40 this year. LEA Podcast is proud to produce a series of panel podcasts dedicated to the ILEA anniversary. We are going over training, chapters, and certification. We'll talk about the past, and we'll talk about the future. So join us on Wednesdays as we celebrate 40 years of ILEA.
Hi, this is Sally Cerber, here to tell you that nobody needs to know what first car you have, or what's your pet's name, or what street you grew up on. We all see these on Facebook, and we all want to answer them. But keep in mind that there are people who are reading them, and they're going to go on your bank account, and they're going to say, oh, I forgot my password. Let me reset it. And the bank's going to ask, what's the first street you lived on? What is your cat's name? And what color car did you own? And the person reading it, they're going to look through your questions, and they're going to answer, and they're going to get access to your bank account. We call that social engineering. So next time you see that survey, that questionnaire, don't.
Welcome back, Chris. One of the questions I like to ask guests is return on investment type question, which is, it's advice for our listeners to where, like, what can they study because it's going to be important 5 years from now? And then specifically for you, I want to get into some of the emerging trends and patterns that you're seeing with cybersecurity and technology.
Yeah, for sure. definitely one area, probably one of the biggest areas to look at, you know, for people looking for something down the line is what they call kind of no code technology. And so, you know, I myself am not a prolific coder or a software developer or anything like that, just kind of a technologist at heart. But there is this movement of building kind of tools and capabilities that people like any of us, you, me, or anyone really could use to build a program and do coding, but it's so simplified, it's almost like drag and drop. And so there's these new tools that are just kind of slowly emerging into the market that specifically target people who don't know how to code and don't want to learn how to code, but could still build a phone app from scratch and have it do all kinds of cool stuff. So there's this huge opportunity for, I think, particularly analysts, law enforcement analysts and crime analysts, often already holding a bit of a technologist role in their job anyways, to start looking at some of these technologies as a way to actually deliver, you know, new capabilities and services to their teams, to their units, and to their divisions.
And we'll put in some links into the show notes, some of this no code information. So it sounds like they're teaching you how to build a bomb, but without really knowing what it takes to build a bomb.
For sure. That's definitely one way to look at it.
So what other types of trends are emerging?
Yeah. So there's a whole slew of kind of, I guess, interesting trends, you know, from a public safety security perspective. So if we look at, you know, any major emerging technology, we could identify a ton of great, awesome use cases that can come from it. But we can just as easily identify a ton of horrible scenarios that we don't necessarily want to imagine. So my favorite example of this is always drones. We've already seen the proliferation of drones kind of in the law enforcement safe, in the space, in the public safety space. We know we have drones being used by wildland firefighters. We've got drones used by, you know, DHS, by local law enforcement for all kinds of use cases. But on the flip side, we have confirmed instances and examples of people who have weaponized drones in all manner of fascinating way. So there was a researcher who actually was able to put a firearm on a drone and make it remote controlled. And so he could fly his drone and shoot the handgun from anywhere, you know, up to a mile away, essentially. We've seen cases, there was a case where someone actually put a flamethrower on a drone and flew it around. That same use case also has some public safety or even utility use cases. Utility companies are looking at using drones with flamethrowers on them to clear debris that may be lying on power lines, like branches and things like that. So it's really fascinating that we're seeing these sort of good guy and bad guy use cases sort of proliferate side by side. The other big one I love to talk about is self-driving cars. You know, you're kind of hard pressed not to see a Tesla driving down the roads at some point nowadays. But while there's tons of interesting use cases that could be a positive for society about a self-driving car, I always like to ask the question, you know, if you work in law enforcement and you have, you know, a crash team or like a crash reconstruction team, even, do they know how a driving car operates and how it's different from a human? Can you recreate a crash where a self-driving car collided into something? And do you understand the physics and how they're different when it's not a human at the wheel? Or could you imagine a scenario where someone robs a bank and instead of having a getaway car, they have a getaway Tesla and they just jump in the trunk and it self-drives them home with all their money? So there are so many, you know, new technologies coming along that we really have to think twice about, particularly as, you know, public safety professionals. What are the risks that we're going to be facing from these? My favorite one that I've been deep diving a bit now more is what they call deepfakes. And that's the ability for people to create, you know, fake videos or even fake audio. And so there's, you know, we looked at that in the private sector. We had a lot of concerns that someone could release a video that made it look like it came from, you know, a chairman of the board or a CEO saying horrible things and just dump it on YouTube. And mm-hmm. we would have to scramble to prove that it was not true, essentially. And so these technologies are just going to continue to develop and proliferate, you know, with or without us. And so I really challenge a lot of analysts and public safety professionals to get with the times as best as they can and stay hip, you know, to the fly as much as they can about these technologies and the risks we potentially face.
Yeah, those deep fakes are fascinating. Anybody that does impressions, that is really good impressionist, I'm pretty sure that there's a YouTube video out there where they'll do a deep fake of whoever they're impersonating.
Oh yeah, totally.
And it is scary good how close it can get.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
So what about social media analysis?
Yeah, so, you know, social media analysis is always been really interesting to me. And I spent a lot of my time at State Police doing a ton of social media analysis, you know, for gangs and organized crime. It was one of the primary ways we collected intelligence. And then when I moved over into cyber intelligence at the Fusion Center, still doing tons of social media monitoring for any variety of threats and hacker groups and things like Anonymous back in the day. You know, all that stuff was all over social media. There was a trend for a while of kind of pushing back on social media analysis. And I say that to mean there was a lot of talk about ways to, you know, increase privacy and deconstruct some of these tools and methods that, you know, a variety of people, you know, law enforcement, but other entities, you know, advertising companies and marketing companies as well, were using to collect data, you know, open source and on the internet. You know, I myself am a huge privacy advocate. So I do support a lot of those initiatives, but we as analysts and as law enforcement personnel and any kind of public safety personnel really have to be careful that, you know, what works today for social media probably won't work tomorrow, and it probably won't work 2 years from now. And so to me, that's one of the most interesting parts of social media analysis is it's constantly changing and evolving. And so you do have to do a lot of work to keep up with it. But personally, I see it as kind of a closing window. It's closing very slowly, but I do foresee a future where a lot of the data that we've traditionally relied on to do open source intelligence gathering and social media gathering is going to start to slip away. It's going to start to become, you know, more protected and more disconnected from Google and things like that. And so we really have to, as analysts, be ready to pivot and find new and different ways to, I guess, address those gaps.
Is that because the platform is going to close that connection that Google can access, or is the end user just going to get more savvy?
I think it's a little bit of both, but I think it definitely skews towards the platforms making those changes. They certainly don't want to make those changes because those same, you know, capabilities are often what empower, you know, their data brokerage services. You know, a lot of, I always tell people, you know, how do you think a lot of these services make money if you're not necessarily paying for it? They're probably making money off some aspect of the data that they collect.
Sure.
And make available. And so really, I think what is going to be the big change that pushes companies to close those gaps is just going to be changes in laws and regulations. So we're seeing a ton of states, Virginia was one of them, that are beginning to adopt more and stronger privacy laws. Virginia now has kind of a data breach law where if an entity exposes records of, I think, more than 1,000 users, they're required to jump through a bunch of hoops and do a bunch of stuff with the Office of the Attorney General and make notifications and all that kind of stuff. And that's kind of the first step in a line of privacy laws that are getting built. We've seen it already happen in Europe where a lot of open source capabilities that were traditionally there kind of disappeared. They've dried up because the GDPR laws over there have actually changed the way companies store and manage data, and they really put a lock and key on a lot of it.
Yeah, and I have noticed that there's more apps on the phone that are asking you for this type of information. At least you're having to give permission to use it. But I will tell you, as an end user, I'm not sure how to answer the question. Right. I am not sure whether I should allow you to have back end data with what I'm telling you or not. It's really hard because part of me is like, okay, what possibly could you do with it? And the other side's like, since I don't know, I should say no.
Yeah. It's definitely a hard burden to put on the end user. And I think that's why we'll see kind of law and regulation kind of jump in to fill that gap.
So you mentioned in the prep call that you had some interesting stories dealing with how you initially got an interest in cybersecurity. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. It's not something I go into detail often about, but yeah, I think this is a unique opportunity to share some of those stories. So I originally got into, you know, technology and cybersecurity when I was really young, actually. It was probably in middle school. when I started teaching myself how to build websites from scratch, how to do some basic programming, PHP and Visual Basic and some other basic programming languages, and building a few different apps and things like that way back in the day. A lot of this was back in the days of dial-up AOL, if you can remember that. And so sitting at my kitchen table, plugged into the phone line, waiting 2.5 minutes to get on the internet for it to make that fun sound it made. Mm-hmm. I kind of fell into all these different kind of online groups and crowds. And I eventually found my way into these sort of secret, underground chat rooms that were just fascinating to me. And so it started out with places where people were sharing like MP3s or maybe movies that were downloaded, things like that. And then I eventually graduated into these chat rooms where people were sharing what they call wares. And that's WARES, wares. And that's a slang term for like cracked or stolen software, essentially. And so people were trading, cracked versions of, Adobe Photoshop or other random software that, people just didn't feel like purchasing for some reason. And then from there, I got into a few different really interesting friendships with people whose names I still don't know till this day. I don't know their real identities at all. They just went by these various, I guess, hacker names, for lack of a better word. I had really good friends with a guy. I only know him as Kraft. That was his name. And he was famous in the AOL hacking world for building these programs. They called them progs. And they would kind of bypass some of the blocks and restrictions on AOL and let you do things you should not have been able to do. Some of them allowed you to do goofy stuff like post, assy pictures in chat rooms or play music that other people could hear. But some of them were a little more malicious. They can kick people off the internet, disconnect them at random, goofy stuff like that. But I was never really a user of these progs and stuff. I was just so fascinated by the culture of it all. And so I ended up becoming friends with a group of people who brought me in actually as an artist. And so I would develop the art that they would put on their progs and some of their websites. And so...
Like graphic design?
Yeah. Like I hate to call it graphic design because it was so not good. It doesn't meet the definition of graphic design. If you were to look back at it, it was a lot of fire, a lot of skulls. It was classic 90s internet stuff for sure. But I just became their sort of resident in-house artist. And so I made friends with this whole crew who did all this crazy stuff on the internet. And again, I was friends with them probably all the way up through high school. So we're talking 4, 5, 6 year relationships with these people. Again, never knowing their real names, never knowing what we looked like. And then, I went to college and just kind of left it all behind. And I'm not even really sure why. I just kind of stopped for, I guess, just to pursue other stuff, I guess. But that was really what set me on this path of technology and being a technologist at heart, I think, was just seeing how people would kind of surge together and create these relationships and these cultures and these groups and chats and all these things that were just around, essentially back then, just hacking and wannabe hacking, really. And it was just so fascinating to me. And so that's really what kind of put me down the road.
Yeah, you'll have to send me some of your graphics.
Find some, I will share it. But it should, by the grace of God, it should be long and gone.
Yeah, it just reminds me, I have a college buddy, Kyle McMullen, has done most of my graphic design for the podcast. And so just a plug for him, moderntype.com is his website. But I was going to say, I could show it to him and he can, make fun of you. I guess as you're doing this, are you doing anything illegal?
Back then with that stuff, I would probably say no. The vast majority of it was not illegal, but it was against the terms of service of AOL. So it was things that AOL could ban you for. I knew a few people who got lifetime bans. I knew one person who got a lifetime ban on, their family account. And so their whole family was banned from AOL, which is probably a really hard conversation to have with your parents if you're young, I guess. So definitely, I did know people who did certainly more illicit things. I knew people who did do fishing. I came across some people who were trying to, you know, steal credentials to other AOL accounts. But a lot of it was just kind of using and abusing the AOL system itself. A really good example was when AOL first started, you could not have a username, an AOL name with lowercase at the start of it. It was just this bizarre rule that AOL initiated when it started, but somebody figured out a way around it. And so,
of course.
Oh yeah. So one of the badges of honor was you had to have a username with a lowercase letter in the front, and that told everyone that you knew what you were doing. And so I actually had mine, my username. I'll share my username. It was the word idiophobia, which is the fear of having an idea, with a lowercase I at the beginning. And I chose that name only because one of the other badges of honor was to have a username that had no numbers and was a word in the dictionary. And so that was the first word in the dictionary I could find that wasn't already taken.
Nice. So it must have seemed pretty innocent at the time, right? I mean, what did you say? You were like middle school, high school age, and you just out there chatting with people that you don't know, and mm-hmm. you're just really trying to make AOL's life difficult.
Yes, it did feel, it felt fun. It was the closest you get to being in a Matrix movie. So it was just fascinating and fun when you're a kid. It almost, you know, I didn't really talk about it with my IRL friends, my real life friends, right? So it was like this second persona that I just lived online, you know, when I was at home.
Yeah. It's funny that you said Matrix, because that was the first thing I thought of when you were talking about the dial up, yes. Right? Because there's that part where he goes into the Matrix for the first time and it makes that weird sound.
Yes. Something that young people watching it now could not relate to.
Yeah, no. So as you go on then, I mean, certainly you had to go through background checks with the state of Virginia and maybe even GE. Does this come up? I don't know if they asked you, did you ever hang out with criminals before? But I mean, did you have to explain this?
I explained it in one background check. I believe I went through one with the Department of Justice. They didn't ask the direct question, but they asked a question that was direct enough that it was relevant to answer. So out of sheer fear, I shared as much information as they asked for, to which the investigator kind of replied, I don't care. That's not quite the level of sophistication I'm quite worried about. Let's leave this out.
That is awesome. I don't care. I can just see you there like sweating, and I would be in the same position. You're like sweating there. Like, do I tell them? Do I not tell them?
I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm caught. They finally caught up
with me. And you're talking, and he's like, oh, I don't care about that. Yeah.
They were like, that's not really what we're looking for. Don't worry about that.
That's pretty lame, kid.
Yeah, basically. Try again.
But you don't know any of these folks. I guess I was going to ask you, have you followed up or have you ever tried to reach out to these folks since then? But you don't know who they are.
I couldn't even if I wanted to. There was a big group of us, maybe like 10 or 12 that knew each other pretty well. Only one of them I ever learned their real name, and it was only their first name. I learned her first name and where she lived. And she actually lived not that far from me, but we never learned anything else about each other. And then oddly enough, I think it was my senior year of high school, kind of as I was, you know, fading out from this group, this matrix life that I was living, I got a phone call after school one day, and I answered the phone, and there's this real low voice, and it goes, hey, is Chris Cruz there? And I go, yeah, this is Chris Cruz. The voice goes, I know who you are. And I'm like, I'm confused. I'm like, excuse me, what are you talking about? I know who you are. And then he starts reading off these various AOL screen names that I've used over the years. So my heart sinks. Like I'm standing in my kitchen. My parents are not home, thankfully, but I'm just standing there. I'm probably, you know, white as a sheet, just terrified, thinking, what is happening right now? And it turns out the guy starts laughing, and it turns out it was that guy I mentioned earlier who went by the name Kraft. It was him. He had somehow figured out my real name and my phone number and decided to call me and terrify me for a couple minutes before we just had a really long, fun conversation. And that was the last time I think I ever spoke to anyone in that group. We talked for a while. He said he was changing his hacker name and he wasn't going to tell me his new hacker name because he had just gotten a job. He was a little bit older than me. He had just gotten a job in IT, a real job, and he needed to change his identity. And so that was the last time we ever spoke. It was a really poetic way to leave that lifestyle behind.
That is so funny. Like, who knows what he is now, right?
He's probably some big chief security officer somewhere.
Except for like Amazon. Was it Kraft, like actual, the word Kraft, or was like Kraft with a K or something like that?
It was Kraft with a C.
Yeah. So Kraft, if you're listening to this, reach out. Email leapodcast at gmail.com. Yeah. But don't hack me, please.
Please.
Oh, that's good stuff there. So, well, I do want to ask you about training. I see on your resume here that you have a variety of training. Is there a particular training that you really like that you would recommend to our listeners?
If I think back of, you know, my law enforcement and intelligence training in particular, there were two courses that I always look back and honestly just loved. I just thought they were the most interesting, most fun courses I took. The first one was the Internet Investigations Training course, which is held by FLETC. And it's a 2-week course down at their campus. And it's awesome. They hook you up with a computer and everything to take with you when you leave. They give you a thumb drive filled with all kinds of software to do internet investigations. It was just an awesome course with tons of hands-on experience. And it's super beginner friendly. So you don't have to be super technical to take the course and learn a lot from it, which I really appreciated. The other course I took, it was right when I started with State Police. It was literally my second or third week on the job. They had an opening for an OSINT, a practitioner course. So it's open source intelligence practitioner course by DHS. One of my bosses came over and was like, hey, we got this seat open. Like, we've already paid for it. Someone's got to sit in it. Can you go sit in its course for a week? And I was like, okay, sure. I'm the new guy. I'll do whatever you say, right? So I sat in the course. It was amazing. It's probably one of the best OSINT courses I ever took. Again, tons of really practical knowledge. They actually made you take like a practical test at the end where they give you this booklet and you have to go through all these questions and test out your OSINT skills. That was kind of like my first taste of OSINT as a practice, I guess, as a skill. Before that, I thought it was just, you know, Facebook stalking. So it was really cool to see that there was like a trade craft to it for me. And just the way they did the course, I just thought was really awesome. So it's one I definitely recommend.
All right. Very good. Well, I'll put links into the show notes again for those two training classes if you're interested. All right. Well, let's take some calls now. Let's go on to Don't Be That Analyst. I actually have a Don't Be That Analyst. And probably this is why I was so excited to do Don't Be That Analyst today. Recently, I emailed a coworker. I said, hey, I need this information mapped. I made a table in Outlook. I said, here's the information I need. And I made a blank column to the right on the table to fill in. I was expecting this typed, returned to me in an email. What the employee did was printed out the email, wrote down in that column what the mapping was, scanned it in, and then emailed it back to me.
Wow.
And so that is definitely a don't be that analyst. I don't know the straightforward way of telling you don't be that analyst that without telling that story, but that is a definitely don't be that analyst.
That is a fascinating level of effort to solve a very simple request.
So how about you? Do you have a don't be that analyst?
Yes, I will say for me, don't be that analyst who doesn't use spell check. And I feel like I shouldn't have to say that, but I have seen it way more times than I should. I once saw an analyst email go out that was so horribly riddled with spelling errors and grammatical errors that someone called me thinking that we had been hacked and were sending out phishing emails. So ever since then, I tell everyone, please, you know, for the love of God, just put the button and use the spell check.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. So, yeah, and actually a little Outlook tip, you can actually turn on spell check to where when after you hit send, it'll go through spell check with you.
Correct, you can,
and,
yes.
And you can set that up so in case you forget to do spell check on an email, it'll automatically do it for you.
Yes, so, that's an awesome tip.
Yeah. So, all right, well, let's take some calls then and see what we get into. First on the line is Nate. Nate, what is your don't be that analyst?
Don't be that analyst that assesses facts. You should never assess facts. You should always be assessing where you can make a judgment.
I think that's fascinating. I never really thought about it that way. Assessing facts, because I guess facts are stuff that you're to assume are true. So you shouldn't be necessarily analyzing facts. But what is your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it feels like one of those things that's like so obvious you wouldn't have to say it, but listening to him say it, it does make sense. And I'm sure myself have been guilty of injecting some level of opinion or providing, you know, an analyst insight on something that really could have or should have just been stated as a plain fact and just left at that.
Yeah. I guess with today, there's so much quote unquote facts or truth out there. We kind of got in the habit of questioning all the facts and the truth, right? It seems odd to say, don't judge facts. All right. Next on the line is Todd. Todd, what's your don't be that analyst?
Hey, Jason. I would just say, don't be that analyst that kind of hangs on to an old report that maybe you manually produce. It takes up a chunk of your day just because, you know, it's what you're comfortable doing all the time. I just encourage analysts to think of something new, learn something new, and improve your product and bring something new to the table in your department.
Yeah, they can write a script like you did, right?
Yeah, I love this one because I'm a huge proponent. I learned this in the private sector, which is stop doing work that doesn't matter. And you'd be surprised how many people are holding on to some ancient monthly or weekly report that nobody likes and nobody wants to read and everyone hates it. You can just retool it or rebuild it or change it up, probably make everyone happier.
Yeah, that reminds me. I had this report that I had to do at Cincinnati Police Department. And I tried my best to automate that report because I hated to do it. It was all this data sources that come in, and of course, there was always one. It wasn't on the system. It wasn't in our data warehouse anywhere. It was just something that somebody emailed over to us. And it was just so annoying to have to try to get this all together. I probably could have used your script. I wish I knew you back then. But it was so annoying that I hated putting that thing together. And I tried really hard to get rid of it because I thought the juice wasn't worth the squeeze in terms of the information that was on there, but it was something that we always did. So they wanted to see it kind of thing. So I never did get out of it. All right. Next on the line is Brian. Brian, what's your don't be that analyst?
Don't be the analyst who puts their department badge or logo on their flyer in more than one place.
I guess if you're particularly proud of your department, you might want to put it on multiple areas. It's kind of funny. Some of these don't be that analyst. They're obviously very personal and they've obviously seen this. So apparently Brian has seen it where there was just a factor memo sent out that plastered with the department logo.
Yeah, it sounds like Brian is responding to a very specific incident he encountered.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of where would you even do it more than once? I mean, usually you have letterhead, right? Mm-hmm. That you might see it up at the top, and even in a PowerPoint, you might have it shadowed in the background mm-hmm. where it was. But it seems like it was multiple times and multiple sizes all throughout the report. So it's funny. Next on the line is Jamie. Jamie, what's your don't be that analyst?
Don't be that analyst who uses cutesy little cats, dogs, rabbit symbols on your map. It's not cute.
Yeah, I would definitely say that for our profession.
Yeah, I think that's a good rule to live by. Yeah. Probably almost any time you're making a map.
Yeah, I mean, if you work for PetSmart, maybe that works. And it's funny, I can't even imagine putting some of that, because usually I have trouble seeing most of the symbols on a map. You know, that's probably old man elder talking. So if, whether I was like a cat, I probably wouldn't be able to even tell a symbol on the map unless it's ginormous. I probably wouldn't even be able to tell that it's a cat or a dog or a rabbit.
Yeah, really.
But definitely it's good advice to know your audience and not to get too cute. And then lastly is Michael. Michael, what's your don't be that analyst?
Don't be that analyst that tries to solve every case that comes their way. The reason is the cases are so fluid and the detectives are getting a lot more information than you are sitting behind the computer. So give them what they need, give them a little bit more, but don't try to solve the case. It's going to save you some headaches and it's going to save you a lot of work.
This is an interesting thought because you never know how far to go. And even with you working in a fusion center, I know how many databases should you search on stuff? How far down the rabbit hole should you be searching on and going through? It's interesting because sometimes I know as an analyst, I was criticized, well, you just did what you were asked for and then you were done. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's what they asked me to do. And he did say, try to do a little bit more, but you know, I'm going to need way more information if they want me to have a bigger impact on the investigation. So it can be difficult to judge when is the right opportunity to just give them what they're asking for versus doing a full court press and trying to get at further details of the case so you can be more helpful.
Yeah, for me, this one feels almost like a personal attack because I am the king of probably over-delivering way more or at least trying to over-deliver more than I should. I'm definitely that person who thinks I'm gonna solve this one. I'm gonna crack this one. Even in private sector, you know, get a case and I'm like, I'm gonna make this one gold. I'm gonna work this one to the bone. I'm definitely that guy who thinks every case could be like the breaking one, the big one. So this one hits close home for me.
It's a weird give and take, especially when you're starting, especially when you're new, a new analyst, to know exactly how the standard operating procedure is going to be, because it'll vary from detective to detective and unit to unit.
Yeah, totally.
All right, well, let's finish with personal interests. I see you have on here urban art and graffiti, which gets back into your high school days, I guess, right? With skulls and crossbones.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess it all comes full circle. I'm a big fan. So I live in the city in Richmond. I'm definitely like a city person. I like city living for sure. I'm just a big fan of, you know, Richmond has a very vibrant art scene. Annual, you know, murals that go up every year and vibrant street art scene. And I'm just kind of a purveyor of it all. I actually kind of keep an Instagram account where I just share graffiti and street art pictures that I find, you know, throughout the city.
Is that legal urban art or is this illegal?
I mean, I am just a chronicler of the urban art. I'm not a creator at all. I assume, yeah. You know, it's mixed. Some of it is, some of the bigger murals and stuff are certainly approved and sometimes even paid for. But some of the other stuff is definitely just traditional old graffiti, you know, people doing stuff they're not supposed to do.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I find it fascinating with graffiti artists or the urban artists, like even the amateurs. I mean, they take their craft seriously and they'll only use certain spray paint or certain materials. It doesn't seem like there's anyone that's actually an amateur. And I mean, obviously there's gang and symbols and some of that conversation back and forth and crossing out symbols and whatnot. But for the most part, when it comes to some of these more complicated urban artwork, there's a craft there.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, passion that they mm-hmm. put into it. And probably what set me down this path was the time I spent doing gang intelligence at the Fusion Center and staring at graffiti from all over the state for hours on end, sometimes just trying to read whatever the hell it was supposed to say, but oftentimes just trying to determine, you know, did it have a gang nexus of any type at all? Yeah, there is this whole, just like I talked about with, you know, the hacking groups, you know, there is this whole fascinating subculture in graffiti and street art where, you know, when you talk about people who are less skilled or maybe not good artists, you know, those are called toys. And so if you ever see, you know, someone's art scratched out with the word toy next to it, that's a grave insult. Those are fighting words in the graffiti world.
Oh, wow. That reminds me, too, just a quick tip. Your city planning or parks and rec also have data, also have databases. And so some of this graffiti or a lot of information that they collect might be in some of these databases. And so you may have access to get access to some of this information. And that's some more intel databases that may be available for you within your own city. So that's definitely something to check out, because it's not like they're all going to call the police and get a record of every single bit of graffiti that's in the city.
Yeah, that's a great call out. You know, they always say, you know, graffiti is kind of the newspaper of the street. So it is it's an interesting data point to monitor.
My last question deals with words of the world. And Chris, this is when I give the guest the last word. So what are your words to the world?
Yeah, I think, you know, my parting thoughts are, in some form, in some way, you know, strive to be a technologist. You don't have to be, you know, an expert. You don't have to be a programmer. You don't have to be a hacker artist or anything quite like that. But just strive to be the person who advocates for solving problems with technology, the person who advocates for considering the risks and threats from technology, and the person who advocates for just making life easier with technology when the options are there. I think I said it before, but I'll say it again. I think law enforcement analysts and all kinds of analysts are in that unique role to play the technologist aspect in their offices. And we probably aren't going to see that coming from a lot of sworn guys and girls. So it really falls on the analyst to pick up that torch sometimes.
Okay. Well, I leave every guest with you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Chris. Thank you so much. And you be safe.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great. Have a good one.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.